Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Jerry Lubinow, Senior Consultant to the University of California's Institute of Government Studies and editor of the Berkeley Policy Press. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. It is my pleasure this evening to introduce two distinguished speakers, Thomas E. Mann, Senior Fellow of Government Studies at the Brookings Institution, and Norman J. Ornstein, Resident Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. They are the authors of The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America, and How to Get It Back on Track. Mr. Mann and Ornstein, aside from being old friends, are two of our nation's most renowned scholars of government and have spent their professional lives studying it, working to improve its health, and helping people to understand how it works. Both are fellows of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and members of the Council on Foreign Relations. Mr. Mann has written several other books on American government, and his writings appear in such publications as the Washington Post and the New York Times. Mr. Ornstein's writings have also appeared in the Post and the Times, as well as the Wall Street Journal, and he writes a weekly column for Roll Call, Congress Inside Out. He serves as an election analyst for CBS News and as a member of the board of the Public Broadcasting Service. Both men have been extensively praised by congressional leaders and others for their attention to and affection for Congress, the people's branch of government. Please welcome Thomas Mann and Norm Ornstein. Tom and Norm will each make a brief opening statement, and then we'll take some questions from the audience. Who would like to start?
Okay.
Tom Mann.
We usually flip a coin here. Well, Jerry, thank you for that lovely introduction. Although, stop coming in here by one of you asking if I could autograph, sign your copy of The Magic Mountain. and I just want you to know I'm fully willing to do that, or Death in Venice, or Buddenbrooks, or whatever strikes your fancy. This is a return visit for me to the Commonwealth Club. I was here a couple of years ago with colleagues from Brookings, including E.J. Dionne, Jr., my dear friend. We had a wonderful time then. It was lively. It was about American politics. As I recall, we were very upbeat. Well, something happened over the last couple of years. I have to tell you, this is the book we've come to talk to you about is not a very upbeat book. And certainly it reflects a sharp change in view and perspective on the part of Norman and myself, who have spent 37 years in Washington, watching Congress, trying to understand it, occasionally working with it to help it reform itself. But lately we have found that instead of rising to its defense, as we have been wont to do in the face of attacks in the past, we have supported pay increases and opposed term limits and defended the first branch of government as inherently conflictual, inefficient, frustrating, but nonetheless the linchpin of our democracy, that institution that provides a human link to the people, that engages in genuine representation and legislation and check and balancing of the other branches of government. Absolutely critical part of our American constitutional system. But that branch is seriously dysfunctional now. We have tracked the changes that have occurred over decades that have been building for some time, certainly near the end of the Democratic reign in power. Democrats were in charge of the House for 40 years running. You can forgive them if they became a little arrogant, heavy-handed, abusing the rights of the minority and engaging in practices that I think did not serve the institution and at times the country very well. Republicans came in with that dramatic victory in 1994 and pledged to do business very differently. They did for a while, but within a few years, they were discovering the, quote, responsibilities of the leadership. David Dreyer, the chairman of the Rules Committee, a Republican from California that we had worked with on reform efforts when he was in the minority, found himself withdrawing from all of the pledges he made while in the minority as to how he and his party would operate in the majority. It was a sad thing to observe. But this sort of pattern of institutional abuse really took on a special character when Republicans found themselves with the first unified Republican government since the Eisenhower years. They had a president with a strong agenda. They had very narrow majorities and decided the only way to govern and to, while advancing that particular agenda, was to turn the House into an agent, really, of the president. Speaker Hastert said proudly, "I am first and foremost the president's lieutenant on Capitol Hill." And Bill Frist, when he moved into the Senate majority leader's position, basically said the same thing. The speaker is a constitutional officer of the United States, having both party responsibilities and institutional responsibilities, but Dennis Hastert didn't really feel that, didn't sense that. And so what we saw over a period of time was a denigration of the institution. We saw in each of its responsibilities Congress failing to exercise them. On the representational front, the links with the public were harmed by a pattern of uncompetitive elections, nonstop fundraising, permanent campaigning, and a collapse of the ethics system in Washington that led members to put more priority on important links within Washington than with the country as a whole. On the legislating front, the greatest legislature in the world, one that didn't simply approve the decisions of others, but was a transformative body, came to denigrate legislation. Committee hearings and markups, dispensable. We don't really need that. Debate and amendment on the floor, we don't want that. It might create some difficulties in passing the president's program. 15-minute votes, which is the standard and the norm for electronic voting, well, if it takes an hour or two or three to get the results we want, we'll do that. Conference committees meet. We don't need to have meetings. A handful of us can take care of this in the middle of the night with a few members from the White House and from the leadership and from the interest group community. Inform votes on conference reports? Well, that would require following the rules of the Congress, providing for 72 hours of layover of a reported bill before it's taken up on the floor of the House and the Senate. You waive those rules, so by having the Rules Committee meet at 2 a.m., report out a rule, start the debate the next afternoon, and then vote on that legislation in the middle of the next night, with most members and staffs finding out what's in it days or weeks or months after the fact. What was once the exception that you did under extraordinary circumstances suddenly became the norm. Then in that third responsibility, the overseeing of the executive, the checking and balancing, Congress proved utterly supine in the face of the most aggressive assertion of executive power, presidential authority that certainly I have witnessed in my lifetime, and arguably more daring than anything Lincoln or Roosevelt did, each of whom, while taking unilateral action, immediately acknowledged the authority of Congress and sought to get their sanction to carry on with those policies. We've seen a dramatic decline in oversight of the executive branch. When you don't ask questions of a president, you deprive him of, frankly, of ideas and other opinions and new information that might force him to think through in a different way the policies he has in mind pursuing. Certainly, it raises questions in a timely fashion to allow for mid-course corrections, but we haven't had any of this. There were 140 hours of committee testimony on the potential electoral misuse of the Clinton Christmas list by the Congress, and there were 12 hours of testimony taken on Abu Ghraib, just to put things in a little perspective. It has so saddened the two of us who think of Congress as the first branch of government, who understand that the system works best when all three branches discover their comparative advantages and in line with Madison's design, have the incentive to exert those institutional prerogatives, defend their institution, thereby keeping the whole system in balance. But when you get a powerful assertion by one body and an abdication by another, the system goes off track. And what has happened is that this has real consequences for the decision-making of government, for the policies that are enacted, for the ways in which they are implemented. In the book, we tell stories of domestic policies and foreign policies that have been woefully inadequate because of the failure of Congress to do its job instead of just saying yes, sir. It's been a very, very difficult period of time. And now when we saw last week in the NBC Wall Street Journal poll that Congress had a 16% approval rating, which was close to a high, in 1994 it was 24%, just to put it in perspective. It got to 15% during the House banking scandal back in 1992. Ordinarily we'd say, well, that just isn't right. It isn't fair. The public doesn't understand. Wrong. The public understands full well what's going on here. They may not have it in all of its details, but the point of our book here was to try to lay it out, to start with the framers, to demonstrate how Congress developed itself institutionally, to pick up in a active way as we came to Washington in 1969 to sort of trace the dynamics of change, and then to show how the ideological polarization of the parties combined with their parity after 1994 have created a dynamic in Congress that is genuinely destructive to good government. The public senses it appropriately, and they are about to react to it. Certainly the election, which is now 2 weeks and one day away, will be one of those national tide elections in which the public says that we're mad as hell and not going to take it anymore. This has been driven in large part by the war in Iraq and public reactions to it. But as part of that, there is a general sense of a dysfunctional Congress and a dysfunctional government. And the public is right about this. The question is there any hope of change? We believe the most powerful levers for change inside Congress are to be found outside. It all begins with citizens who will take the time to care, to pay attention, and to vote. Because if politicians in Washington sense the public is so cynical that nothing matters, then they have no need to change their behavior. So everything begins with one team in power being tossed out by the voters and the other team being held to a very high standard, and rigorously so. It's fascinating, by the way, for me to come out to San Francisco. I did a Pacifica radio program yesterday, and along with Elizabeth Holzman, who's written a book calling for the impeachment of George W. Bush, I was arguing I thought that would be a rather unwise move for the Democrats to engage in that activity when, in fact, the country's desperately looking for them to be forward-looking. Obviously, there are important investigations to conduct to get to the bottom of some really dreadful behavior of contracting abuses and the rest. But 8 years after one misuse of the appropriations process, of the impeachment process to initiate another, seemed unwise to me. And ironically, I found myself defending Nancy Pelosi in the face of all these calls from people who said impeachment should be the top of the priority list for Democrats when they take power, as I believe they will in the House of Representatives. So go figure. It's a diverse country with lots of views. But the point here is that the process of returning Congress to a position that the framers would recognize to once again represent, legislate, and oversee the executive is going to take a lot of work. It's going to take high standards enforced by the public on whichever team is in power. There are things that can be done. They're not going to happen overnight. All I can say, and I would conclude with this observation, however down we are about the state of American politics and the behavior of Congress, it's important to remember that there was no golden era when everything worked perfectly. Our government has never worked perfectly, and our great strength as a people is that we recognize that. We're not perfection. At times, we get seriously off track. What we are capable of self-criticism and self-correction. And we're now at the stage of needing to acknowledge what's wrong, to get the diagnosis exactly right, and then to prescribe some strong medicine. We do that, and we'll turn this around and be proud of our government once again. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks so much. It's a delight to be with you. I wanted to do a couple of housekeeping things. Jerry had mentioned the places that we have published. I want to mention one thing where I think it's a trendsetter and something completely new. Tom and I, for probably the first time ever, maybe the last time ever, simultaneously have pieces out right now in Reader's Digest and Foreign Affairs. Probably not much overlap in readership there, except in a few months when people are in doctor's offices and long waits. Gina, early on, was saying how nice it was to work with our book publicist at Oxford University Press, and I did mention that we actually have better publicists. Dennis Hastert is probably the best publicist we have for our book. Mark Foley may even be a little bit better. And John Doolittle is doing his part, too, even as we speak. Now, I wanted to bring you up to date a little bit on news. There is some breaking news this morning. Of course, the biggest news of the last month, really, other than Iraq, has been North Korea with Kim Jong-il and his son, mentally ill. But Iran is back in the mix as President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad this morning announced that Iran would conduct its own nuclear tests in defiance of the international community. And I'm afraid I have some troubling news. President Bush was asked this morning about that, and I'm afraid he seriously injured himself trying to pronounce Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Thank God he didn't try to say nuclear, or he might have been out of it for a long time. It's been, of course, a rough few weeks for President Bush. He just got the results back from his annual physical, and I'm afraid he's put on some weight, probably a little too much barbecue over August in Crawford. So his body mass index is up to 28. But that puts him in a category alone with William Howard Taft, the only presidents whose body mass indexes equal their approval ratings. And I want to remind you that William Howard Taft's body mass index was actually quite high. The president said a few weeks ago, I kid you not, he said, I can't win. You know, they say I'm out of touch and I don't listen. And then when I do listen, they say I need a warrant. Just a little other news. Of course, many of you grew up as I did, memorizing nine planets. And it's been very traumatic the last couple of months since the astronomers kicked Pluto out of the planetary system. But this morning, Pluto announced it would run as an independent. So I think that will change things. And just a little campaign news. We have a report today of the best-selling bumper stickers. First, the best-selling bumper sticker of the 2006 campaign is in Virginia, the Virginia Senate race. It's a George Allen bumper sticker that reads, Oi, Macaca happens. But the best-selling bumper sticker for the 2008 campaign is Run, Hillary, Run. Not surprising, perhaps, since in every survey, Hillary Clinton leads among Democrats in preferences. But oddly enough, the bumper sticker Run, Hillary, Run is selling even better among Republicans, who are apparently putting it on the front bumpers of their cars. This Congress is a disaster area. I noticed last week Jay Leno said that this Congress is so bad, this is not an election coming up, it's an intervention. And except, as Tom suggested, it's going to take more than a 12-step program, I'm afraid, to correct things. I wanted to get you laughing a little bit because there isn't a whole lot to laugh about from this point on. Tom and I came to Washington together 37 years ago in the fall of 1969, both of us to work on Capitol Hill for a year. And we have been following Congress closely, working in it, immersed in it, and moving many times to try and change it institutionally and otherwise for that period. And we've never seen it as bad as this. And to get to a bottom line here, it's simply no exaggeration to say that this country's at a crossroads in many, many ways. And it is simply an awful time, perhaps the worst time imaginable, to have dysfunctional institutions. Now, you could talk about a book as The Broken Branch, and without the subtitle, not necessarily know which branch we were referring to. The fact is we've got broad dysfunctionality in the political process, but it's led by our first branch of government. We know over the next several years that we have a budget crisis looming that could explode into something worse than we could even begin to imagine. The fact that the budget news of the last couple of months has been relatively good news. Corporate tax revenues have come in at much higher amounts than anticipated, and our deficit for the coming year is down to somewhere in the range of 2% of our GDP. But the fact is that our long-term prognosis for our revenues coming in is somewhere between 16 and 17% of our GDP. We are currently spending about 20% of our gross domestic product at the federal level, and we know that the spending level is going to explode dramatically. It'll explode because defense costs continue to rise very significantly. One thing that Iraq has exposed is, even though we have a troop level that most military observers, if they were honest, would say was much lower from the get-go than we needed to deal with what we needed in Iraq. The fact is, at the levels we have, we are dangerously spread thin. We have a National Guard and reserve forces that have gone through, some cases, three or four or five tours of duty, something that they had not anticipated. They do not have the cushion or protection that regular military forces do. They lose their jobs. Their families don't have the kinds of safeguards. And you can't do this indefinitely. We need more people under arms, and that's a very expensive proposition, not to mention the ongoing drain or costs of the war itself. We have homeland security needs that are substantial and are not being met. Congressman Ed Markey said a few days ago, and it's absolutely right, that it is harder to get into many New York nightclubs than it is to get into any chemical plant around the country. We don't have protection for chemical plants, for ports, and many other places, and to do so is going to cost more money. But let's face it, the real drivers of budget growth are in the entitlement programs. The three big programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, and Medicaid is primarily not a program for able-bodied young poor people, but for the elderly. The single largest component by far is long-term care in that program. Those three programs combined today amount to about 42% of the federal budget and are about 8% of our gross domestic product. Well, of course, we have, to start with, the baby boom generation. Bill Clinton and George W. Bush both turned 60 within the last month and a half, and they are the cutting edge of a generation that in 2 years will start to draw down from those programs more than they're putting in. And combined with that, we have the other reality that the fastest growing age group in the population is the over 85 group, and within that the over 100 group. It's getting harder and harder to watch Willard Scott these days because the list is a long one. So be prepared, because the geezer boom is going to meet the baby boom, leading to a big boom. And basically the Congressional Budget Office tells us that, using very modest assumptions of health inflation, that by 2040, those three programs alone are going to amount to 20 to 24% of our GDP and basically consume the vast majority of the budget, 80% or more. That means more than we're spending now in government for three programs without a dime allocated for interest on the debt, defense, homeland security, education, the environment, highways or other forms of transportation, diplomacy, or anything else. And obviously, you move to a revenue base of 16 to 17% with more tax cuts to come, no matter who's in charge, and spending going to 24, 25, 26, 27% of GDP. That's a gap that is not sustainable. My late colleague Herb Stein once coined something known as Stein's Law. If something can't go on forever, it will stop. But how it stops is another question. And what we know is that to restrain the rate of growth of those three programs so that they don't basically act like a giant tapeworm crowding everything else out is something that cannot be done without broad bipartisan consensus and bipartisan leadership cover. And we're further away from that than we have been in our lifetimes. to be able to even grapple with those kinds of fiscal problems. And of course, if you think about any chance of developing a consensus, even roughly, on where we go with America's role in the world, we're further away from that, and we're descending into the abyss of having all the national security questions become tough, vicious partisan issues the same as anything else. Once you move in that direction, you have a real risk, because the fact is there are evil people trying to kill us. And if we divide along partisan lines, and what that means is, as we saw during the Clinton years, when President Clinton wanted to do something in Bosnia and Kosovo, Tom DeLay and other Republicans in Congress opposed him reflexively, not because of the policy he was pursuing, but because he was Bill Clinton. And that kind of division is not good for anybody, and we have a lot of work to do to try and come to even a broad consensus on where we are, where we're going. And when we head into a campaign where John Boehner, the House Majority Leader, summons reporters before Congress leaves and says, well, you know, I think maybe my Democratic friends are more interested in protecting terrorists than they are in protecting Americans. If that's the kind of campaign we're going to run, how can you begin to move afterwards to forging at least a common ground in which to discuss what we do, whether it's Iraq, North Korea, the Middle East, Pakistan, dealing with China, or any of the other difficult issues ahead? Now, the fact is, of course, as Tom said, that we have a Congress that is more poorly equipped to focus on these things, to step back and look at the larger picture, or to make policies that will benefit the country in the short run or the long run because of this breakdown that's occurred. It's been a long time coming. It hasn't just been something that's a reflection of one party taking over the majority. Some of it has to do with the sharp polarization that has taken place in our politics as the South transformed from a firmly Democratic area and a Democratic Party that kept a majority in Congress for 40 years by having a kind of unholy alliance in some ways between Southern conservative Democrats and non-Southern liberal Democrats who put aside many of the issues, including the most important ones that divided them, civil rights, so that they could maintain their hold on power. And then the South transformed to a competitive region and then became the Republican region that it is today. While the Pacific West, as many of you remember, was a strongly Republican region for a long time and then transformed, as the Northeast, parts of the Midwest did, into elements of a Democratic base. And as a consequence, our parties have become more like parliamentary parties in many ways. In Washington, at least, it is very difficult to find a Democrat who does not fit in with a cohesive, basically liberal point of view, or a Republican who doesn't fit in with a cohesive conservative point of view, even though there are some differences in what liberalism and conservative mean. But the old boll weevil or blue dog Democrats are an endangered species, and the old, we used to call them gypsy moth or moderate liberal Republicans, are a trace element in American politics, and this election will make them even fewer. So that kind of polarization has made a difference. The fact that in our current culture, where any book by Ann Coulter or by Michael Moore immediately shoots to the top of the bestseller list, and they become guests on every program analyzing politics, is a part of what's taken us to where partisanship is no longer simply healthy respect for differences or even strong butting of heads, but a kind of tribalism where you aren't out to defeat somebody on the other side. You want to crush them into the dust and make sure they can never reappear again. And, of course, with the parity we have in American politics, these close divisions, the Democrats may very well move to a larger victory in 14, 15 days than they've anticipated, but we're still going to have a close margin in the House, and it will be up for grabs again the next time. Whatever happens in the Senate, we're going to be within one or two seats, and it'll be up for grabs the next time, and the stakes become very, very high. And through all of that, we have a legislative body that has lost sight of the larger picture of what they're supposed to be doing, of focusing on solving problems for the country as a whole. The fewest number of days in session this year than in our lifetimes, and even fewer than it appears on the surface. 93 days, but of those, 65 in the House were full days. The rest, they had no votes before 6:30 p.m. Several of them, they were basically there in a pro forma session, 11 minutes or so, to say that they were there, and then they went away again. How are you going to solve problems in the country when you're around for 65 days? And when you take about 10 of those aside so that you can focus in the fall, as they did in the House and earlier in the Senate a few more days, on constitutional amendments to ban same-sex marriage, to stop the epidemic of flag burnings that's been sweeping the country, or to make sure we have God and the Pledge of Allegiance, while knowing that none of them was going to move to any kind of resolution, but just to throw them out there because now the focus is on ginning up your base to make a campaign effective rather than on grappling with what people really care about. It's led, as Tom said, to the collapse of the regular order, to the demise of any deliberative process. How can you do anything when you're around so little? How can you do any oversight when you're around so little? A sense in the legislature that in the majority that all that matters is that you act in concert with the president, you become his lieutenants. And frankly, that's also led to what is a culture of corruption. Reading this morning the story in the Chronicle about John Doolittle, whose race may be tough, but surprisingly so, given the overwhelming Republican nature of his district that goes from Sacramento all the way up to the Oregon border. But John Doolittle, among other things, besides his close relationship with Jack Abramoff, also worked out this wonderful deal where he hired his wife to do the fundraising for the campaign, and she gets 15% off the top of all the fundraising done. And reported in the story about how they'd arranged to have President Bush come out to campaign with John Doolittle, and they raised $600,000, a nice little $90,000 nest egg for the Doolittle family. Well, I don't view that as a very good way to create confidence that you have a Congress that's actually doing things for people. And, of course, at the center of this is the explosion of earmarks deliberately built in so that they could have a breakwater against members being in trouble because they could have $200 to $500 million or more apiece to distribute around in goodies, but which has led to large numbers of people, including the Speaker of the House, managing to focus earmarks in places very close to where they own property, and the Speaker himself with a $207 million double earmark for a highway interchange near his own property went virtually overnight from a $300,000 net worth to a $6.2 million net worth. And, of course, Randy Duke Cunningham taking bribes directly and others. It's a cascade of problems. Not one that's going to lead to confidence by the country. Now, I want to say our book is critical of the Democrats, as Tom said, for their rule and times when, after 30-plus years, they grew enormously arrogant. We're harshly critical of the people who've been in power now. But we have not just gotten some boost in support for our thesis from Democrats. True conservatives, people like Jeff Flake of Arizona, Joel Heffley of Colorado, who was fired as chairman of the Ethics Committee for doing his job, Dan Lundgren as well, who served during a time when he was frustrated at being in the minority at the quashing of minority rights and believes that they ought to be there even if you're in the majority, have all said that this is a system rooted in dysfunctionality right now. We're hoping this book can jolt people into a little greater reality. And we've issued a warning to the Democrats as well, that if they're in the majority and they behave in the same fashion, we'll be all over their case as well. The proof will be in the pudding after November, we hope that you will read this book. Even more fervently, we hope you will buy this book. We would note it makes a great gift as well with the holiday season approaching. But more than that, we hope you will get more engaged, because the fact is the country can't handle dysfunctional institutions like this for very long. Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking tonight with Thomas E. Mann and Norman J. Ornstein, authors of The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America, and How to Get It Back on Track. We have a large number of questions, and we're going to try to get through them fairly quickly if we can. A number of them have to do with specific reforms. You mentioned some briefly about redistricting. We were told for a long time that redistricting was such a terrible problem that we wouldn't be able to get any sort of change. Now it suddenly seems like there are a lot more districts in play. What's happening?
Redistricting has contributed to a decline in the competitiveness of congressional districts, but it's only one of many factors. Perhaps most important is the fact that as Americans, we decide to move our residents to places with like-minded people, same values, same place in life, same political views. So we create homogeneous regions that contributes to lopsided Democratic and Republican districts. It's also been a period in which partisanship has come to mean so much more to all of us. We view political life through our partisan lenses. We are, even if we say we're independents, we're really not. We lean toward the Democrats or Republicans. We don't split our tickets as much. We vote party line votes. That creates sort of lopsided Democratic and Republican districts that contribute to the strong ideological polarization between the parties. Now, Jerry, the good news is that while this introduces a lot of rigidity into our system, and some people feared it would be virtually impossible for the electorate to basically change the government because of the non-competitive districts, we still have enough flexibility to permit change. Right now, there are probably 60 to 75 Republican seats that are potentially in play in the House out of 435. There are maybe a dozen Democratic seats in play in this election year. A change of 15 seats in the House would produce a new majority. A change of six seats to the Democrats in the Senate would do the same thing. The odds are strongly now, given the evidence that we have from a year of very negative polling results on the country's attitude toward the party of government and the condition of the country, and now the same results showing up in individual races, we should not be surprised to wake up and see Democrats having gained 30 seats or more in the House. And in the Senate now, they could gain 5 or 6 or 7. And so they could be one vote shy or a 1 or 2 seat majority. The point is, when the parties are at rough parity, the majorities are small, the country is angry, you can still get a change in course in spite of the decline of competitiveness.
I just want to add one small note. I disagree with Tom on one thing, that yes, people are moving into areas where they're like-minded folks, but here in San Francisco, I've seen much, much more diversity. There are people who wanted to impeach George Bush yesterday, and there are some who want to wait till tomorrow. A few who are willing to wait till January. So it's a lot more diversity here.
Let's pursue the question of impeachment, because there were a number of questions regarding impeachment. Is there any real possibility at all that anyone's going to introduce or make any effort for impeachment? And what would the procedure be, and how? I mean, what are the likelihood? What's the who would come into office if he was impeached, and if Cheney were impeached, as some people suggest? And then they might want Dennis Hastert.
I mean, you're
impeached.
Beginning to get the idea. Right. First of all, if you just think ahead to the second part of the process, impeachment is like an indictment. Then there is a trial in the Senate, requires a two-thirds majority. Republicans will not vote to impeach their president. Therefore, it's all futile. It's like spending 3 weeks on debates on same-sex marriage and flag-burning amendments. It really is the moral equivalent to that. It's of no consequence in real terms, except for the political fallout that that would occur, which I would argue would mainly work to the disadvantage of a new Democratic majority. Yes, there are important investigations to
conduct about pre-war intelligence and its use, about contracting in Iraq and in New Orleans following Katrina, about the administration of many programs. But at the same time, there's important hearings to be conducted with Republican, growing numbers of Republican as well as Democratic critics of the war, of what in the world we do there now. The country wants to, will exercise its judgment on the past behavior on November 7th. What they then want is a functioning Congress that that can hold the president accountable, that can give voice to new information, new ideas, and hold out the possibility of setting a different course for the future that might deal with some of the problems we confront.
Let me just say first that a Speaker Pelosi is too smart to follow down that path and has already set the groundwork so that it won't happen. There's a danger for Democrats on several fronts in a majority, and some of that danger was shown by the way Republicans reacted to Bill Clinton and the public reaction to it. In 1998, a midterm election where historically the party in power loses seats in Congress, the Democrats actually gain seats because of a public reaction against the impeachment efforts by Republicans there, and it didn't stop them. They kept moving forward. If you have a tunnel vision and decide that this is your opportunity to gain vengeance, to make revenge the watchword, you're going to be in the majority for 2 years and nothing more than that. Now, I think we have to brace ourselves for what will be very tense periods, because you have a president and vice president who have the most, not just the most expansive view of executive power, but really believe it is part of their calling to protect and extend that executive power. So, as Democrats move to do a combination of very tough and maybe even overdone investigations, but also very legitimate oversight in the areas that Tom mentioned, there'll be massive resistance from the administration. They won't let their people testify. They'll take them all to court. We're going to get constant constitutional confrontations. And managing that so that it doesn't careen out of control, so that we don't end up with our government becoming the War of the Roses, where there's everybody so intent on blocking the others that we all go down the hole together, is going to be a tough, tough set of issues. That's a major challenge for the Speaker. And there'll be another challenge for Speaker Pelosi, which is building any kind of unity among her own Democrats. The Republicans succeeded to a strong degree in the first 6 years of the Bush administration, starting, remember, with a six-seat majority out of 435 in the House, because they maintained almost perfect party discipline. Republicans believe that if they hung together, they wouldn't hang separately, as it were. The problem Pelosi will have is the morning after this election, if we have the results and Democrats have a margin of, say, five, you're going to get 50 Democrats waking up saying, I can blackmail them for anything. The sense of wanting to hang together and subsume your own interest to the larger goals here will not be there. And having a very divisive struggle for a majority leader, which is in the cards right now, where they divide themselves before they even get underway, is another part of the problem.
Let me follow up on that. There was a question regarding Republicans and Democrats who operate across party lines, and there seems to be one of the things that's going on in the election is a purging of moderate Republicans. Is there a significant number of people in Congress who are willing to operate across party lines?
Not a significant number. The number has declined, and that's part of the problem. In 1994, it was the more conservative Democrats who were vulnerable, representing Republican districts, who lost disproportionately. And this year, it's the more moderate Republicans in districts that are slightly Democratic or more balanced between the two parties who are most vulnerable. You see them in Connecticut, in New York, in Pennsylvania, Ohio to some extent. So the ranks of the Republican moderates will decline. Now, listen, the reality is both parties have moved over time to their ideological pole, but in a different sequence. Democrats did it really in the 70s, and part of it was the regional realignment, the demise of conservative Southern Democrats. then actually Bill Clinton led them back in many respects to the center. So they're the party of fiscal responsibility and not quite the wild-eyed radicals. Republicans had their movement to the right more recently, certainly beginning with Reagan, but Reagan proved actually quite pragmatic at near the end of his presidency. George W. Bush has really moved his party strongly to the right, in spite of the frustrations of some conservatives. It seems to me, Jerry, to really have any chance of building a cross-party coalition, you have to have a president who's determined to make that part of his modus operandi. And without that kind of leadership coming from the White House, it's unlikely that you will see much movement across party lines.
Well, Norm, let's follow up. How do you see President Bush dealing with the Democratic Congress, or say with a Congress that's split?
It's going to be a real decision point for President Bush. Will he now become a uniter, not a divider, after being a divider, not a uniter, for the vast bulk of his presidency? Will he go back and do some of the things that he actually did do when he was governor of Texas and faced a different and more adverse political environment? The pressure on him to do so is there in part because now, as a second-term president, he can look to legacy. And what legacy are you going to have if you, having done almost nothing in domestic policy, and whatever was done very early on. The No Child Left Behind was just about it. And then we got to the Medicare prescription drug bill done in a very partisan way that it's just not a good piece of legislation. Nobody, I think, would want it as their particular legacy. If your final 2 years are spent vetoing every bill that comes along after doing one veto in your entire 6 years before that, and bickering and moving to the courts, what does that say about your presidency? But the president is, I think, psychologically fixed on the opposite position. He's got an opportunity now. Tom is absolutely right. While Nancy Pelosi said that as Speaker she will not be what Dennis Hastert was, she won't be Speaker of the majority of the majority, she'll be Speaker of the whole House. And she won't shun the majority, the minority, which is what the Republicans did on all issues, not just ones that were there were sharp ideological differences. As we point out in the book, things like dealing with maintaining a Congress if there's another terrorist attack, which has no ideological or partisan grounding at all. In fact, the strongest proponent in the Senate of dealing with this issue is John Cornyn, one of the most conservative members of the body, Republican. In the House, it was Liberal Democrat Brian Baird. But the House Republicans made it a partisan issue because they could. She said she'll reach out to those moderate Republicans. There won't be very many to reach out to. But there will be Republicans who will go along if the president works out an arrangement with the Speaker and with others. He can do it on immigration, as a matter of fact. He can get the kind of bill that he wants if he's willing to give up 40% or 50% of his Republicans who make up his base, who will go ballistic if he does so, to cut a deal with the other 50% of the Republicans and 50% of the Democrats. That's doable. The odds of him doing that, I think, are very, very slim. He took a lesson from his father, who, after all, did the budget deal, violated the Read My Lips, No New Taxes pledge, and went down. But that meant his father couldn't serve a second term. If he takes that as his lesson, there's no legacy.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking tonight with Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein, authors of The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track. We had a number of questions regarding the problems of money, which both of you I know have done a lot of work on. One had to deal with McCain-Feingold and how effective that's been. The other has to do with the K Street Project, where it seems that there's been a shift. Some of the money's starting to go to Democrats. Are things going to be any better under Democrats than Republicans?
An excellent question. First of all, on the McCain-Feingold, this is the one piece of legislation of a major sort that managed to get through Congress after years of struggle and was whose constitutionality was upheld by the court. It was a very limited piece of legislation that dealt with two things, the so-called soft money, unregulated money, that came ostensibly to political parties to engage in non-electoral federal election activities, but became a way to subvert the long-standing limits on corporate and union treasury funding of federal elections. The other thing it was designed to do was to take so-called issue ads that were by not saying vote for, vote against, elect, defeat a candidate, were able to become the major vehicle by which organizations and parties campaign for federal elections. A modest bill, didn't really transform much else. It didn't do anything about public financing or anything else. But in those limited respects, it actually worked well. The parties are thriving today, playing a more important role than in many, many decades in American politics. The stories you read today about the last weeks of the campaign are about what the Congressional Party campaign committees are doing, where they will allocate their millions of dollars in independent party spending and in key races. And to understand the dynamic of this race is to see how the Republicans are withdrawing funding from certain races to defend existing members, and Democrats are moving out to second and third tier races. The reality is the law took care of a particular problem. The parties now have to raise this money in limited amounts and not from corporations and union treasuries. They've been immensely successful, and that's a good thing. The downside is that money has become a consuming interest to politicians on Capitol Hill. They spend enormous amounts of time raising it. Even those who are safe now feel obliged to raise it so as to be able to compete for committee chairmanships. We had a bidding war for the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, and Jerry Lewis won. It was very sad. We've now seen the kind of corruption that's moved into the appropriations process with a movement of staffers to lobbying firms who are paid enormous sums to acquire earmarks designed for particular companies. So we have real problems in the system. There's some small steps in the book we recommend taking. They're probably much larger steps. Money will always be a problem in our politics. It's not just that there's too much of it. It's what it takes to raise it and how it's distributed afterwards.
Let me talk for a minute about the K Street Project. You know, Democrats were certainly not immune from the notion of securing their people in lobbying positions and then raising a lot of money from them or using their majority positions to get corporations to pony up. Brooks Jackson wrote a book many years ago called Honest Graft about that process. But as in so many other areas where you had abuses on a scale of 1 to 10, where Democrats would hit maybe 6, Republicans hit 11 since they've taken the majority. The K Street Project really was a much more explicit attempt to create a kind of self-reinforcing loop. It was to go to trade associations, lobbying firms, corporate offices in Washington, law firms, and say, you're going to fill these positions with our people. And in many cases, not just, you better pick some Republicans, pick these people, specific individuals. And in some cases, you will fire the Democrats who are there and replace them with Republicans, or else. And the or else in some cases got specific. For example, we had the Financial Services Committee in the House go to the Investment Company Institute, the Trade Association for Mutual Funds, tell them if they didn't fire their Democratic lobbyist and hire a specific Republican, that hearings on the industry would turn very sour and legislation would emerge. We had a situation where one trade association refused to hire as its head the specific Republican, hired a Democrat instead, and two treaties of the United States were held up for months that they wanted. Then they get these people in place, in many cases where they did, And you'd have staffers who went from making $50,000 or $60,000 a year to making 10 times that much. And then they'd go to them and make sure that they maxed out on their political contributions back so that they could be sure they could stay in power and keep this loop going. And, of course, along the way, the lobbyists were basically given carte blanche. In many cases, they would be the ones in the room late at night when the conference committees would meet, shutting out many of the members, write the legislation, it would get slipped in without a day of hearings and enacted as they wrote it. That pretty much is what happened with the bankruptcy bill, among others. It's like the Gilded Age, and it's worse than we've seen. And if Democrats try and do the same thing again, it will fail. And frankly, we've only begun to touch what the Justice Department in its very aggressive investigations have been doing. Jack Abramoff was the poster child here. There are more. There are a lot more members who are going to get caught in the crosshairs here. Greed took over, and they will pay, but we've suffered.
We have a number, and we're running short on time, so maybe we can go through a number of these fairly quickly, sort of what-if questions if the Democrats do take over, what they might do. One has to do with the question of the use of secrecy and problems with transparency in government, congressional oversight. Would that improve?
There will be much more oversight. There's a political incentive because you have divided party government. The question is it serious, substantive oversight, or is it kind of scandal-focused, gotcha politics? That's going to be a real test, Jerry, for the new Democratic majority.
Yeah. What about on foreign policy? There are obviously a number of problems with Iraq, North Korea. Is there any chance that we will return to a situation where foreign policy problems stop at the water's edge? Or
no,
change in this?
Not in the short run. And, you know, this spills over into other areas. If you go through a campaign where you say to the other side, traitor, 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 and then you turn around the next day and say, come, let us reason together on Social Security or on foreign policy, it's not going to work very well. What I do hope will happen is that if we do get tough hearings and at least some more aggressive oversight on foreign policy, that you will move to some reconsideration of policies that aren't working. The failure to do oversight means that in an attempt to avoid short-term embarrassment, you create the possibility or likelihood of disaster occurring. And if you can raise some things that are embarrassing but force reconsideration of policies, maybe we'll get a more rich foreign policy. But that's the best we can hope for, and I'm afraid it's going to be very tough.
With some of the problems that seem to be arising with electronic voting, can we be sure that the votes will be counted this time?
No.
We can never be sure that the votes will be counted. Now, we never were sure in previous decades. We had a lot of problems that we didn't know about. All of us discovered this in November 2000 in the state of Florida. Additional problems have come to the fore. I'm scared. I hope we get a decisive outcome of this election, because if the majorities depend on a couple of races determined by a couple of hundred votes, hundreds of Republican and Democratic lawyers are going to the courts, and it will be awful. So let us pray for a decisive result on November 7. We're going to be wrestling with these voting administration problems and issues for years to come.
Tom and I are engaged in an effort over the next 4 years to try and clean up our electoral system, because we need more than just prayers that this year doesn't result in an election where the House is within two or three or four seats and there are eight or nine or ten that are within a couple hundred votes apiece, and you can't recount in some cases, and the machines are in highly questionable condition in others. All of the manufacturers here, by the way, are at fault. Diebold is the absolute worst, but they all just want to make a quick buck and have no interest in accountability for those machines. It goes beyond the machines. You don't have people who know how to run them. We have errors in administration that are massive. We live in Montgomery County, Maryland, one of the best-run districts for elections. At least they took pride in that. When we went to vote, this is supposed to be off. When we went to vote this last primary, I got there at 6:45. The polls open at 7:00. We couldn't vote for 2.5 hours because They'd forgotten to bring countywide the cards that activated the machines. We need lots of money, much more than we have in our elections. We need seriously trained poll workers. We need different kinds of machines. Congress enacted a bill, the Help America Vote Act, after the 2000 results. It's not adequate. We need something more. There's no appetite in either party for going after this, and they have to be pressured. And this is something where the American people have to demand something more. And the fact is, no elected official wants to spend money on elections. They'd rather spend the money on garbage collection or things that affect people day by day instead of twice every 2 years.
We've reached a point, unfortunately, we have time for one last question. And there are a number of questions that had to do with the media, but let's just ask you if the media has failed its obligation in reporting on Congress, in maintaining oversight both in Congress and the presidency. Are they to blame for any of this?
Yes.
Tom?
Listen, it's the best of times and the worst of times with the media. I can identify 6, 8, 10 dozen reporters who do fabulous work. But that isn't what the American people see. They see local television news coverage of weather and traffic and crime and maybe a little bit of scandal put on top of that. There's been a dramatic decline in the overall coverage of public affairs, politics, government. More and more people go to news outlets on the internet, on radio and cable news that reinforce their existing views. The places and settings where people come to hear both sides of an argument to get new information are declining. So in that sense, Norman's absolutely right. The broader media have really failed us.
Let me. I can't resist saying, when I travel around and coming here too, I will watch the local news, especially in an election season, and then just watch local stations. And it's palpable and obvious here in San Francisco as much as any place. The news shows do no coverage of the local elections. And why? Because the more they cover the elections, the less incentive there will be for candidates to provide advertising revenues for them. So the fact is they have consciously cut back on their coverage at local television. And California has been the leader in this, I might say. And they're pulling in obscene sums of money for all of these ads. And you can't escape the ads any minute of the night and day now. Local television is supposed to have, broadcast television, a public interest obligation. They say, the broadcasters, that they spend $10 to $12 billion a year on their public interest obligations. I'm willing to take them at their word and say, let's relieve you of those obligations. You pay over 5 years 5% of what you say you're committing here, and after that you'll be relieved of all of your obligations, and we'll take that money and put that into a trust fund for public broadcasting and let public broadcasting have real resources to put it on. Anything they do in the public interest, they do because it's in their business interest, period. And television has become a pathetic element of our American democracy. So it's time for a change.
Our thanks to Thomas Mann, Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, and Norman Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, authors of The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Jerry Lubinow, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.